Good morning, I'm Chris Farrell, and you're listening to NPR News, and I'm glad you could join us today. The landmark 1973 U.S. Supreme Court case known as Roe v. Wade or Roe v. Wade is cited as having made abortion legal in America. And while that's true, what the decision itself says is this, that no state may make laws regulating abortion during the first 3 months of pregnancy except to provide that they be done by licensed physicians. So tomorrow, Wednesday, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, will hear a case involving a Mississippi law that bans abortion earlier than 3 months, after 15 weeks, including in cases of rape and incest. Legal experts suspect Wednesday's case could overturn Roe v. Wade because of the makeup of America's high court has changed since both the 1973 decision and other challenges. So what will this mean for Minnesota? What is our current state law governing abortion? How did we get here? And what might happen to abortion in Minnesota if Roe v. Wade is overturned? So this show, this program, is not about the right or wrong of abortion. This show is about the future of abortion in Minnesota. So if you have questions concerning the possible changes in the legality of abortion in Minnesota and our neighboring states, give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Now I want to introduce our guests. Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at Florida State University and the author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Welcome, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Hermer is the Professor of Law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul and the author of the recent article, COVID-19, Abortion, and Public Health in the Culture Wars. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jill Hasday is a professor of constitutional law, family law, and legal history at the University of Minnesota Law School, and she's the author of two books, Family Law Reimagined and Intimate Lies in the Law. Hello, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you all are here, and like I say, reaching out to our audience, we're taking your calls, but we're not going to debate the right or wrong of abortion. Instead, we're here to answer questions about the future of abortion in Minnesota and the neighboring states. So if you have a question, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. And Mary, I'm going to start with you. Take us back before 1973. I mean, what was the state of abortion rights before Roe v. Wade?
Before Roe v. Wade, to some degree, it was the way it is now in the sense that laws varied by state, but most states criminalized abortion except in situations in which a patient's life would be at risk. There were only four that allowed abortion without restriction, and a little over a dozen that allowed abortion only under a very limited set of circumstances,
Okay. Which
meant that for a lot of people, the only option was illegal abortion.
And so was abortion ever legal before it became illegal?
Yes. So if you go far enough back, there was a common law tradition in the United States of abortion being legal until quickening, which was the point at which fetal movement could be detected, which usually varied some by pregnancy, anywhere between, you know, the 16th and up to the 20th week. In part, I think, because there was no real way to prove that there was a pregnancy until that time. And it was only really in the late 19th century that states began introducing laws criminalizing most abortions.
Okay. And so, Jill, walk us through Roe v. Wade. I mean, what did the court decide and how did they decide it?
Okay. So Roe v. Wade is the first case where the Supreme Court places constitutional limits on a state's ability to restrict abortion. Roe v. Wade frames the abortion right in privacy terms rather than equality terms, I think in part because Roe was decided in 1973 and the court's sex discrimination case law is only just getting off the ground. In contrast, they have a number of cases, for instance, about access to contraception that are decided in a privacy mode. So Roe adopts that sort of privacy reasoning. Actually, one of the most surprising things about Roe when you read it is it speaks so much of a doctor's right of autonomy in medical decisions that it's there's much less than you would think about a woman's desire to have an abortion or why she might want one. It's, a lot of it is really about doctor's autonomy. And Roe sets up a trimester framework where basically states cannot restrict access to abortion in the first trimester. In the second trimester, they can limit abortion to promote the mother's life or health. And in the third trimester, they can prohibit abortion. At the time, the line between the second and third trimester very neatly tracks with medical viability. The idea of viability is, what's the moment, in theory, when a fetus could survive outside the womb? Not that most fetuses at that age of development would survive, but where it's medically possible with the best equipment and $1 million for the fetus to survive. At the time of Roe, that's right around where the first semester, where the third semester starts. Now, with medical developments, it's moved, earlier in the pregnancy. So Roe sets up the three trimester framework. It's in a privacy framework. The other thing that's very interesting about Roe is that Roe is 7-2. Even the dissents, so for instance, Rehnquist dissents, have no idea that Roe is about to become this defining political issue. They know it, there's some controversy, but Roe isn't, as we think of Roe now, like it's going to be one of the few Supreme Court cases where ordinary people know the name. There's no sense in the initial opinion, oh, this is going to be the opinion where everyone knows the name of this case.
Ah, and Laura, so from a legal standpoint, you know, why is Roe v. Wade so controversial?
Why is Roe v. Wade so controversial?
From a legal standpoint.
Well, it's based on this right to privacy, and what's interesting is sort of how the legal framework has shifted from a right to privacy to a liberty interest under Planned Parenthood versus Casey, at least in the federal jurisprudence. Whereas, for example, under state law, under Minnesota law, the right to an abortion is grounded through the Minnesota Constitution in a right to privacy, even though that case was, in fact, decided after Casey. The state court decided to retain the right to privacy basis.
Okay. And then this is – so as this right to privacy, this has become – has that become sort of have justices become more skeptical about this over time?
The justices have indeed become, at the federal level, have become more skeptical about the right to privacy over time. And, through cases in the 1970s, later in the 1970s, and then in the 1980s, started shifting away from this right to privacy basis. So even though, the contraceptive rights are based in that right to privacy. And then you have this autonomy right for the right to, for instance, the right to die, the right to refuse life-sustaining treatment. And so one thread that I think we need to keep in mind throughout this debate is that if we're talking about overturning Roe and overturning Casey, other cases that are sort of along those lines that use the same sort of legal reasoning, the right to use contraceptives without state prohibition, and the right to refuse life-sustaining treatment, those cases are also potentially thrown in jeopardy.
And so, Mary, Jill had mentioned, it was a 7-2 decision. The justices at the time didn't think that, it was going to be as controversial as it has become. So what was the initial reaction to Roe, and when did it become such a heated political issue?
Well, I think one thing to emphasize is that it already was a heated political issue. So there were state-by-state battles about abortion before Roe. I think the court believed that it could help settle the conflict because its decision was roughly in line with polling at the time. What they didn't realize is that people who feel differently about abortion feel quite passionately about it, and it's an issue that really is their only voting issue. So immediately after Roe, the anti-abortion movement, which had already been very active in the states, got rallied around the idea of a federal constitutional amendment that would ban abortion everywhere. And in fact, in 1974, Congress actually held hearings on this sort of amendment. But it took a while for the kind of polarization we've seen around the issue today really to take shape, that there were different things that had to fall into place. It had to become a wedge issue in partisan politics, which hadn't really fully become the case until really the 1980s. And then, of course, other things in the years since have exacerbated our divide, whether that's the fact that we gather our information from entirely siloed partisan sources and don't necessarily trust authorities when it comes to scientific facts, or even the growing partisan divide writ large, especially the rise of negative partisanship. All of those things have intensified our conflicts around abortion. But I think one common mistake is to assume that Roe gave rise to this conflict. It was simply intervened in a war that had already begun.
So what Roe did was it gave a legal decision to focus on different positions around.
Exactly. And I think what eventually became clear was that Roe was a perfect way for the anti-abortion movement to build an alliance with the GOP. For years, the anti-abortion movement didn't really have a political partner. Neither party was reliably pro-life or pro-choice. There were pro-life Democrats and pro-choice Republicans and vice versa. But once that alignment coalesced, it was something that it appeared the GOP could deliver, right? So the GOP's promise was, if you elect us, our presidents will pick justices you like and our senators will confirm them, and eventually we will bring you to a day when Roe v. Wade is overruled. So Roe v. Wade became a target that both the anti-abortion movement and the GOP could aim for. But it didn't create the conflict, and I don't think overruling it would resolve the conflict.
And so, Joe, off of this, and I know there are libraries, shelves that are filled with this question, but when we're thinking about Roe v. Wade, tell us about what's the difference between how state law works and federal law works?
In the abortion context, federal constitutional decisions tends to set the floor. It works in two ways. The federal decisions set a floor that states can't go below. So, for instance, many states have so-called trigger laws, where the second Roe v. Wade is overturned, they are announcing their intent to prohibit abortion. But when the U.S. Supreme Court says that the federal Constitution requires some access to abortion, those state laws are preempted. We have a federal system, and the federal Constitution trumps state law and state constitution. So that's one way it goes. Another thing, and that's usually where the focus is in terms of federalism, it's the federal constitutional decisions of the Supreme Court stopping some states from being more restrictive of abortion than they would otherwise be. Again, though, the federal constitutional decisions are just a floor. States can be more, can provide more access. So, for instance, Minnesota, in some ways, provides more access. The Supreme Court, in part because it defined abortion in privacy terms, held that the federal government had no constitutional obligation to fund abortion care for indigent people receiving Medicaid. In contrast, the Minnesota Supreme Court interpreted the Minnesota Constitution to say, in fact, in Minnesota, there's a constitutional right to privacy that protects indigent people's access to abortion if the state is funding other childbirth and pregnancy-related services. So that's an example where the federal constitutional law sets a floor, so states can't go below it, even if they want to, but they can go above it if they would like. And in some contexts, Minnesota has gone above that floor.
Okay. And then, Mary, what's happened to Roe v. Wade since 1973? I know this is a huge thing, but Casey, for example, has been mentioned. So are there significant challenges that should be emphasized, significant rulings since 1973 that we should be aware of?
I mean, there are lots of them, but I think the most important, as you mentioned, is Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which came down in 1992. Casey really was decided at a moment very much like our own. There was a conservative supermajority put in place by Republican presidents who had pledged to reverse Roe. And I think then, as now everyone expected the court to reverse Roe, the court didn't entirely. The court preserved what it called the essential holding of Roe, which was the idea that there's a right to choose abortion before viability, but it got rid of the trimester framework that Jill described and replaced it with what's called the undue burden test. The undue burden test allows states to regulate abortion unless doing so creates a substantial obstacle in the path of someone seeking an abortion. As you may imagine, this standard was easier for states to satisfy than the trimester framework would have been. And so when we're talking really about what the Supreme Court is going to do to Roe, we really don't mean the Roe Jill described. We mean Roe as it was transformed by Casey. And ever since then, when we're fighting about what states can or cannot do when it comes to abortion, we're fighting about Casey, not really about Roe in its original form.
And Casey was decided in which year?
1992.
Okay. So, Jill, why is the Mississippi case being heard? I mean, there was the Texas case recently, but they're looking into the Mississippi case. So why is the Mississippi case the one that the Supreme Court seems to be focusing on?
Okay, so the Mississippi passed a law banning abortions, including in cases of rape or incest, after 15 weeks. And by 15 weeks, they mean 15 weeks from the first day of your last period. So it's about 13 weeks of actual pregnancy. And the court, if four justices agree, they can take any case basically they like. Four justices agreed. And the question they're considering is whether any bans on pre-viability abortions are constitutional. So Casey said that for pre-viability abortions, states could impose restrictions as long as those restrictions didn't place an undue burden, but that states couldn't prohibit abortion. That's obviously an undue burden. The court's willingness to hear the Dobbs case suggests, well, there's two readings of it. One is that a majority of the court is ready to abandon Casey and this idea of undue burden and allow abortion restrictions maybe without limit. Another, and that's most of what Mississippi is arguing, is that abandon Casey, abandon the idea of constitutional limits on a state's ability to regulate abortion. An alternative argument Mississippi is making in defense of its law is a 15-week abortion ban isn't an undue burden because most abortions are performed before 15 weeks of pregnancy. If the court accepts that, they could say they were not overturning Casey, but it would radically transform the abortion right, allowing states to prohibit abortion before viability. And just to talk about the practical realities, why do people get abortions after 15 weeks? One might be, you have that 20-week scan and you discover that your fetus has a condition incompatible with life. In other words, you might give birth, but that pregnancy will be stillborn or the child will survive 2 days in great pain, et cetera. So that's what the Mississippi law is, if it went into effect, is about. So the court's willingness to hear the case suggests that they're, at least four of them, are interested in either scrapping the Casey framework or potentially altering it so fundamentally that it would be Casey almost just in name only.
So as a follow-up, so let's say they uphold the Mississippi law. Then another state says, no, it's 10 weeks. And another state says it's 5 weeks. I mean, do you anticipate?
Right. It depends on the theory. If they uphold the Mississippi law and they say the reason we uphold the Mississippi law is because the Constitution places no limits on a state's ability to restrict abortion, then, yeah, states can do whatever they want.
Okay.
If their theory is we're upholding the Mississippi law because the vast majority of abortions are 15 weeks or earlier, then that argument wouldn't work as well for a 10-week ban.
Okay.
So it depends what their reasoning is. In any event, if they uphold the Mississippi law, many other states are going to be rushing to do whatever they can. But what they'll be able to accomplish really depends on what the reasoning the Supreme Court uses if it ends up upholding the Mississippi law.
And Laura, when you read about the Supreme Court, you read a lot about, the importance of precedent and, not being arbitrary in what they overturn. So why is this current court seem poised, and I emphasize seem poised, to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think it has to do with the absence of abortion being discussed in the Constitution or anything that might arguably ground that, at least from the perspective of the number of the justices sitting on the court right now. So when you have this right to privacy and then later on this liberty interest being grounded more in implications from rights that are expressly provided in the Bill of Rights, and when you're not given as much leeway to rights being reserved to the people that have not been expressly discussed in the Bill of Rights, then it becomes easier to not respect or to find less of a basis to preserve these sorts of rights, or to find that they're actually held.
Okay, so I want to ask each of you what do you think the court will do? And I'll start with you, Mary.
I think the court is going to overrule Roe. I don't think the court is going to overrule Roe in this case. So I think my guess would be the court is going to say viability is not an appropriate line. They will focus on criticisms of viability offered by everyone from, Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court Justice, to bioethicists. And I think they're going to avoid saying a lot else, because the tricky thing, of course, if you're the justices, is if you want to overrule Roe, but you don't want to do it quickly because that's going to make you look partisan, and that's something that clearly the justices have been anxious about in recent months, then you also don't want to define or clarify what an undue burden is, because then you're going to have to turn around and overrule that in a year or two. So if they're going to not clearly and openly reverse Roe, my guess would be they get rid of viability and maybe then just send the case back to the lower courts, saying, everyone has been acting under the mistaken assumption that viability is the line. It's not. Take a second look at this Mississippi law now that you know that. Because I think if they are eventually interested in reversing Roe, they're not going to want to inadvertently reinvigorate the idea of an undue burden.
Okay. And Jill, same question to you.
Okay. So this is about stare decisis. So the Supreme Court, on the one hand, isn't bound by its past cases. It's the court of last resort. It can change its mind. On the other hand, there's a lot of reasons for the Supreme Court to honor its past precedents. As Mary was suggesting, what does the Supreme Court have, right? It doesn't have an army. It doesn't have the purse, the public purse. It ultimately has the fact that whether people believe in it or not, right? Do we accept their decisions as legitimate? That's all it has. And there are some cases where it gathers political capital, and there's other cases where it spends it. Being in a situation where you said in the headline, Roe is overturned, would be spending an enormous amount of political capital, and it wouldn't, and the court is eager not to have those kind of outlays. One way you can tell that the justices, I think, are very alert to this is when they go on speaking tours. So after the Texas law, after the court allowed the Texas law to go into effect.
And just give us a brief definition of the Texas law.
The Texas law is sort of the same idea as the Mississippi law, but draws the line much earlier at six at. It's, I think it's eight weeks, but it's, which means like 6 weeks after your last period. And normally when a law that is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decisions is about to go into effect, the court issues an injunction. Basically, the law doesn't go into effect and we'll let the case go through the courts and decide. The Supreme Court allowed the Texas law to go into effect in Texas. That got a lot of attention. It was very unpopular. And if you notice, many justices started doing a number of public engagements around that time, talking about the role of the Supreme Court and we're above the fray. And why is that? Because they saw that they were spending political capital maybe more than they intended to spend, and they're worried about it. So I agree with Mary that the court is going to be eager to not spend more than it has to. And the only other thing I would say is that the Constitution isn't an algorithm. People have different interpretations, and we have a majority of the Supreme Court that was chosen in part because their interpretation of the Constitution is that it doesn't protect the right to abortion. So part of what happens is the membership changes over time through, you know, political changes, and so those new people interpret the Constitution in different ways.
And Laura, same question to you. What do you think the court will do?
Well, on the one hand, I completely agree with both Mary and Jill that the incremental approach that they're discussing to chipping away at the right to an abortion is likely to prevail. But something I'm really disturbed by the court's failure to act on the United States and then also Whole Woman's Health request to enjoin the Texas law, which as Jill described, it's this 6-week ban, but it's not enforceable by the state, but rather by any individual anywhere in the U.S. who is aggrieved by either someone performing an abortion after 6 weeks or simply aiding an abortion after 6 weeks, for instance, driving a woman to a clinic. And they haven't acted on that petition, or those petitions rather. pardon me. And so I'm concerned that they might not be acting on this because they may very well be considering overturning Roe and Casey altogether. I agree with Mary that is where they're almost certainly going to be ending up. And the question is simply when at this point.
I'm Chris Farrell, sitting in for Angela Davis. And now let's get back to our conversation about tomorrow's Supreme Court proceedings. The justices are hearing a case involving Mississippi's law banning abortion after 15 weeks. And we have three legal experts with us today. Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at Florida State University and the author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Laura Hermer is a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul and the author of the recent article, COVID-19, Abortion, and Public Health in the Culture Wars. And Jill Hasday is a professor of constitutional law, family law, and legal history at the University of Minnesota Law School. She's the author of two books, Family Law Reimagined and Intimate Lies in the Law. Now, we are taking your calls, but we're not going to debate the right or the wrong of abortion. Instead, we're here to answer questions about the future of abortion in Minnesota and neighboring states. So if you have a question, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. And a listener did send us a note and wants to know if you can please explain why the right to privacy was the legal reasoning for Roe and not something else. Jill?
Many people have asked this question. Even supporters of abortion rights often find Justice Blackmun's opinion for the court in Roe unsatisfactory. The court's privacy case law was just much more developed at the time of Roe, and Blackmun really understood abortion as a right to be left alone, to just do what you want without the state making a decision for you. There's definitely, I think, something to this, right? There's some force to this. But the privacy framework has ended up having real limits. I think that those limits were most clearly revealed in the cases about the Hyde Amendment. This is the federal law that prohibited the use of federal funds for abortion care for indigent people receiving Medicaid. And the court basically said, well, abortion is a privacy right. It's a right to be left alone. It's not a right for a state to help you. So it really shows the limits, I think, of a privacy reasoning. Many other people have suggested that abortion would be both stronger constitutionally if defended in sex equality terms, that this is about especially women's rights to control the course of their lives and decide where they want to spend their time and what they want to do. And without access to abortion, women's ability to invest in education and employment, et cetera, is compromised. There have been, even though abortion is still officially has always been framed in privacy, if you look at Casey, that's the 1992 decision that reshaped Roe while keeping the idea of constitutional limits on abortion regulation. Casey has much, although it's officially in privacy terms, has much more kind of equality reasoning about a woman's right to control her own destiny, which you really didn't see in Roe. So both of these themes are there. But if you wanted to say officially, how is abortion protected under the Constitution? Officially, the court has said, is part of a privacy right.
Okay. And Mary, anything to add to that or to this listener's questions about, you know, the right to privacy?
Well, I think Jill is right that it's primarily just that the court was building on a range of existing precedents touching on everything from the use of contraception to the right to marry to the right to parent. And that's what makes, I think, for the Supreme Court, the enterprise of overruling Roe, even if that's what the court wants to do, a bit fraught, because the court is likely to say, if it overrules Roe, that, you know, there's no, the original public meaning of the 14th Amendment, which is where people often root an abortion right, didn't recognize a right to abortion. So in other words, the people who wrote the 14th Amendment at the time of the 14th Amendment wouldn't have thought there was a right to abortion, because at the time, many states criminalized abortion. The problem with that argument is at the time, there were federal and state laws criminalizing contraception. There were federal and state law, well, certainly state laws criminalizing same-sex sex or even oral and anal sex. So it's difficult to kind of draw a line between the two unless you do so by saying there's something unique about protecting fetal life, but that too could lead the court to a tricky place, which would be potentially the argument that some anti-abortion groups have made, which is that abortion is unconstitutional because a fetus is a rights-holding person under the 14th Amendment. So for the court to thread that needle is going to be challenging, in part because there is this real kind of tapestry of privacy decisions that the court has created. Even though privacy arguments have been criticized, there is a sort of rich tradition of privacy reasoning that the court's created. And I think the court that decided Roe was looking to that tradition in framing its decision.
And Laura, want you to weigh in?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, on to tick part of Jill's thread. The right to privacy can be conceived as somewhat impoverished, but I think that it also allows a court to draw the right somewhat larger. And so, for instance, under Minnesota law in Doe versus Gomez, the right to privacy was held to encompass the woman's decision to terminate her pregnancy. And so it grounds this decisional right, and in fact, it's large enough to ground the state's provision of public funding for women who qualify for medical assistance, and so it can be writ somewhat larger. And as Mary mentioned, you know, at the federal level, the right to privacy has undergirded a large number of other sort of intimate rights that I think many Americans take for granted and would be, I suspect, rather shocked to find out, if Roe and Casey are overturned, that these other rights may potentially be in jeopardy should a state want to enact laws that seek to infringe on them in ways that aren't permitted now.
Give us an example.
For instance, if a person who was unmarried wanted to get an IUD or birth control pills, not for a non sexual reason, non-reproductive reason, a medical reason, but rather just to prevent conception. That might be one thing. To have a right to make certain medical decisions.
Okay. So now I want to shift looking ahead. And I know we touched on this, what is the current Minnesota law says about abortion. But just to reiterate, Jill, can you explain what is the, you know, what is the current Minnesota law?
Okay. So as I said, Casey said that states before viability could impose could regulate abortion as long as those regulations did not pose an undue burden on access to abortion. In the actual Casey decision, the court said that 24-hour waiting periods don't constitute an undue burden. This is when the pregnant person has to go to the doctor and then wait at least get some information from the state and then wait at least 24 hours before actually having the abortion. For people who are poor or live far away from abortion providers or who are heavily regulated by employers or family members, it can be very hard to have these two appointments, and it can take much more than a day. But in Casey, the court said, undue burden is always very fuzzy, said that's not an undue burden. Minnesota has one of these 24-hour waiting periods. You can do the first visit by telephone, but it has to be a doctor. And the state statute includes various information that the doctor is supposed to tell you. Some of it suggests incorrectly a link between abortion and having an abortion and breast cancer, where there is no medical evidence to support that, but that is part of what the doctor is supposed to go into with you. So you have an appointment. It can be over telephone, and then at least 24 hours has to pass before you get the appointment. That's straight from Casey. Another interesting feature of Minnesota law is the Supreme Court in another case had held that minors, so people under 18, states can impose parental notification provisions where you have to get some either notification or in some states the parents' consent before you have an abortion. The court said that's constitutional as long as there's a judicial override possibility, where if you don't want to tell your parent or if your parent disagrees, you can go to a judge. Minnesota is unusual. It might be the only state, I'm not sure, but it's certainly unusual in that Minnesota actually has a two-parent notification requirement, so you have to notify both parents. As you can imagine, in some cases, this is quite difficult.
Yeah.
And if you can't, then you have to do the judicial override, which is complicated. You have to figure it out. It takes more time, et cetera. Minnesota also requires that the abortion be provided by a doctor rather than another kind of trained medical professional. So that's another just restriction on the availability of abortions. Something I didn't know, but I recently found out is there's also, so Minnesota itself places restrictions on abortion. There's also, it's also important to keep in mind that what one state does has implications in another state. So as I said, the Minnesota Supreme Court in Gomez said there was a state constitutional right, if you were indigent, to have the state medical assistance pay for this abortion because it's paying for other pregnancy-related care. The state's current rate for reimbursement, the amount of money it actually gives the doctor, is very low, is way below cost. So it's very difficult for abortion providers to actually provide abortions to poor people because they're just not getting paid enough to, you know, run the clinic. My understanding is that Whole Women's Health, which operates in Texas and also operates in Minnesota, was basically using some funding from its Texas abortion clinics to help pay for Minnesota abortions for indigent people because it wasn't getting enough money from the state. And with the Texas abortion law in place now, those resources have dried up, so it has implications for the availability of abortion in Minnesota. So I think I think it's easy to think it's other states that have restrictions on abortion. You don't hear much about anti-abortion activity in Minnesota compared to other states, but Minnesota itself places restraints on abortion. Also, abortions are prohibited in Minnesota after 23 weeks.
Okay. So Mary, let's say Roe v. Wade is overturned. What do you think the map of the country is going to look like?
It's hard to say, right? I mean, I think current estimates are somewhere, you know, between 20 to 25 states will ban all or most abortions very quickly. A lot of these states have so-called trigger laws, which will go into effect as soon as Roe is gone. Others have retained pre-Roe abortion bans. I think that that's likely eventually to be an underestimate because of places like Florida, where I'm based, that have become much more conservative in recent years and also have, I think, moved away from policies that would please the majority of the electorate toward policies that would energize the base. So I would guess that we'll see kind of a, and this is a crude breakdown, but three kind of rough categories of states, mm-hmm. or four, maybe even progressive states that are going to try to make it easier for people to get abortions, not only within their state lines, but even potentially to help people travel from out of state or obtain abortion medication if they're in states where abortion is illegal. States that are going to ban almost all or all abortions without exceptions for rape or incest, and then states that will be sorts of battlegrounds that may land somewhere in between or ultimately in one camp or another. I think Minnesota is likely to be somewhere similar to where it is now, where abortion is restricted but not banned. And other sort of what we think of as battleground states may go one way or another. It's worth saying, though, that this kind of patchwork is not going to be the end of the story. Anti-abortion groups have already argued that if the Supreme Court is willing to reverse Roe and incur the kind of political fallout they're going to see, that the court may be willing to recognize fetal personhood and make abortion unconstitutional. So we're going to see ongoing litigation at the court, even if the justices do overrule Roe. And there's some anti-abortion groups suggesting as well that if the court will reverse Roe, they might be willing to reverse decisions recognizing rights to same-sex marriage or prohibiting the criminalization of same-sex sex. So we're likely to see that. And then I think finally, another thing that's worth emphasizing is that states don't all agree on what it means to criminalize abortion because they don't agree on what abortion means. So some conservatives, for example, believe that IUDs and emergency contraceptives are abortion-inducing drugs and may include those in abortion prohibitions, as well as some aspects of treatment for infertility. So when we're talking about bans on abortion, those are likely to sweep in more than what some people may conventionally think of as abortion.
And so define for us fetal personhood that you mentioned.
Yeah, so the argument, which is really the original argument of the anti-abortion movement, it goes back to before Roe, is essentially that the people who wrote the Constitution, particularly the 14th Amendment, when they used the word person, they intended it to apply before as well as after birth. And if that's true, then a fetus has rights to due process under the law and to equal protection of the law the same way an adult pregnant person would, which would mean that abortion would be constitutionally suspect, like quite likely entirely unconstitutional. This argument's again based on a particular reading of what the people who wrote the 14th Amendment thought. It's not one that's shared by, you know, everyone, certainly even by all conservatives, but that's kind of the moonshot or the dream of the anti-abortion movement, because as you can imagine, these are folks who believe abortion is murder, and they're not going to be thrilled about a situation where states like California and New York, which have by far the highest rates of abortion, by far the total highest raw number of abortions, continue performing abortions and are able as well to offer them to people from out of state. They want a nationwide mandate. So you're going to hear a lot of talk about democracy and restoring this to the states. That's not really where anyone believes this is going if really either social movement has its way.
And so, Laura, what do you think, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, what do you think will happen here in Minnesota?
Well, here in Minnesota, for the moment, certainly, I think that we will continue to have a right to obtain an abortion, you know, until viability, which as Jill mentioned, is 23 weeks here. I suspect that we would see a fair bit of legislative wrangling, especially with a divided legislature, attempts to further restrict abortion in Minnesota. And I'm not sure quite how that is going to play out. I think there's substantial support for abortion rights among the electorate. The question is how will this play out in the legislature? One issue that I think does bear noting is, you know, now that we have medication abortion for pregnancies, you know, technically up to 10 weeks, and it's used a little bit longer in other nations, that this could be a game changer for abortion, such that even in places where it is made illegal, it's going to be difficult to completely prevent people from obtaining drugs to terminate their pregnancies. So you have a number of jurisdictions that have sought to criminalize self-abortion, and also, you know, including South Dakota, those that have a ban on mailing medications for abortion. Yeah, but how do you enforce this in practice? And that's going to be a real question.
Well, we could keep going on, but we're getting toward the end of our time. And I want to ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Mary, you know, in the minute that's left to us, what are you going to be personally, what are you really going to be listening for tomorrow during the hearing?
Well, I think there are three justices who are the justices to watch, just Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. I mean, they're not really, I mean, calling them swing votes or center of the court is misleading because the court is very conservative and we're not looking at, I don't think, a scenario where there's a win for supporters of abortion rights, but those are going to be the deciding votes likely. So I'll be interested to see to what extent they seem interested in focusing just on viability or to what extent they seem ready to go big and potentially get rid of Roe and Casey. And I'm going to be looking at how they talk about precedent, whether they act as if they feel constrained by precedent or if they seem to think there's a way around it.
Laura?
Yeah, very much looking at the focus on precedent and that coming down.
Okay. And then, Jill, what will you be focusing on?
I agree with all of that, and maybe another way of saying it, though, would be I'm going to be thinking about, are they framing this case as a big case, or are they looking for ways to narrow it? So one strategy might be they'll uphold the Mississippi law, but in a way that in some ways doesn't address larger questions, and sometimes you can see the justices looking for ways to do that, and sometimes you can see them looking for opportunities to go big.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful conversation. Mary Ziegler is a Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at Florida State University. Laura Hermer is Professor of Law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul. And Jill Hasday is a Professor of Constitutional Law, Family Law, and Legal History at the University of Minnesota Law School. And I'm Chris Farrell, sitting in for Angela Davis. And this show was produced by our senior producer, Susan Davis.
Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.